This is Jennifer Joyner from the Triangle Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina, South Carolina, by Nancy Roberts. So sit back and get ready to be scared. Chapter 1, The North Room, Currituck Lighthouse, Corolla, North Carolina. Built in 1874, Currituck Beach Lighthouse has been a comfort to mariners along the dark and hazardous 40 miles of coast that lie between Cape Henry to the north and Bodie Island to the south. Visible to ships from 19 miles away at sea, the flashing light says, "Keep your distance." Today, this once isolated area swarms with tourists, but few of them know the eerie story that took place here. It started first with one death and then another, until superstition grew. This story is about the strange feeling people have when they enter the north room of the keeper's house. The families of both the keeper and the assistant keeper live in the same building, but if this sounds a bit too cozy, it is really a duplex with each family enjoying its own private quarters. Scarcely visible from the exterior of the building, in its lovely setting of trees, is the fact that we are actually looking at two identical houses divided imperceptibly down the middle. Historian Lloyd Childress, a tall, dignified lady, relates something that happened when she first arrived at the historic site and was showing a tour group through the house. "When we came to the north bedroom, I led the way so that they could follow, and then turned and waited for them all to go in. A young man entered, and then, quite suddenly, he backed out of the room. I asked, 'What's the matter?' And he said, 'Oh, I can't possibly stay in this room.' 'Why not?' I inquired. 'Because there is a presence here, and I can't be in the same room with it,' he said. He would not go in there. I went to one of the members of the board of directors and said to him, 'Do you want to tell me about any of the bedrooms in this house?' He smiled and immediately answered, 'Oh, you must mean the north bedroom. That's where the ghost of Lovey is said to be. She was the wife of William Riley Austin, one of the last keepers stationed at Currituck. Miss Lockwood Powers, a friend of hers, visited her here and stayed in the north room. Mrs. Powers, who was stricken with a mysterious illness, died during her visit, and her body was placed in a horse-drawn cart and taken home to Kitty Hawk for burial.' Miss Childress continued, 'A gentleman who stayed in this side of the house during the early stages of the restoration would not enter the room. It's no wonder. Did I tell you about little Sadie?' she asked, and I shook my head. 'Well, Sadie was the child of the first lighthouse family to live here, and everyone in the village knew the little girl. Her parents, George and Lucy Johnson, doted on her. Mrs. Johnson would do needlework to occupy herself, but her child was never far from her thoughts. I'm afraid Sadie was more venturesome than she should have been, and her favorite pastime was building castles in the sand not far from the surf. Day after day, her mother would walk outside to check on Sadie and see her little body crouched down, small hands pressing sand together for a tower or digging a moat around an elaborate castle. Her head, with its lovely golden hair, would be bent in concentration. Sometimes Sadie would lose herself in the details of walls and turrets as the tide crept closer and closer. When she came home, her shoes and dress would be drenched as if a sudden surge of foaming surf had caught her, and with its malicious hand swept away part of her castle. The natives said she would stamp her foot in anger and shout at the sea, 'Don't do that! Don't you hear me? Don't do it,' I said, as she tried to replace a destroyed section of a tower or bridge. But one day, playing at the edge of the water, she took off her shoes to wade. There must have been a powerful riptide, for before she realized what was happening, the sea swept her out far beyond her depth. Her little arms must have flailed out, and perhaps she shouted angrily at the water, 'Don't do that! Do you hear me? Don't do it!' I said. Her frantic parents searched until dusk, and then were joined by volunteers with lanterns, but to no avail. It was not until the next day that Sadie's body washed ashore and was found by a local fisherman. And since the north room had been hers, her parents laid her there before the burial. "Several visitors believe they sent spirits in this room," continued Lloyd Childress. So saying, she opened the door to the north room. "At least two have received the impression of a very strong presence in here," she confided, as we entered a gloomy little room with only two windows. It was as depressing and foreboding as a mausoleum in contrast to the bright world outside, where parents and children chattered as they queued up, waiting to crowd into the souvenir shop or the lighthouse. There was an unreality about all that happy activity below, in contrast to the gloomy aura of the room I stood in. I thought of Sadie and her bright life, snuffed out by the sea, and then of the keeper's wife who died here. "Who was she?" I asked, "and of what did she die?" "Why, that is really John Wilson's story over at the Roanoke Inn," said Miss Childress. "He inherited this lighthouse keeper's house and has been instrumental in seeing that it is restored through the efforts of Outer Banks conservationists. But according to the records of the keepers who were here, an unidentified keeper's wife suffered from tuberculosis, or consumption, as they called it then, and finally died. There were three families stationed at Currituck at a time, and this was one of the last. The north room also belonged to the ill young woman. I can imagine her, in her isolated quarantine, staring down at the grounds below, watching others engage in all the activities for which she was now too weak. There was nothing that could be done for tuberculosis then, and people were very much afraid of it, knowing how contagious it was. Upon this poor lady's death, every article of clothing she owned, down to her smallest possession, was thrust into a wooden barrel, which was then sealed and left in the north room. The family moved away. Everyone had a dread of touching anything that had belonged to her, fearing that even a handkerchief or petticoat might carry the deadly infection. After the house was abandoned in 1938, children in the village were told, "Don't ever touch the barrel." Of course, that only aroused their curiosity. The first thing they did was to come into this room and find the barrel. Prying up the lid, the children pulled out one piece of clothing after another. A coat, a hat, a dress, a scarf, and wearing them, they paraded about the house. When this macabre game of playing dress-up was discovered, the dead woman's clothes were boxed and burned, said Miss Childress. Although there have been guests here from time to time, keepers do not live in the house today, nor are they needed, since the lighthouse has been automated. Duties like cleaning lenses, trimming wicks, fueling the lamp, and winding the clockwork mechanism to rotate the beacon are now as outdated as the lighting and snuffing of city streetlights, followed by the reassuring cry of, "Ten bells and all is well," sung out by night watchmen a century ago. But is all really well here at the keeper's house now? According to John Wilson, the owner, no guest in the house has ever been willing to spend an entire night in the north room. The Currituck Beach Lighthouse and Museum Shop are open daily from Easter through Thanksgiving. During periods of high winds or thunderstorms, the lighthouse tower may be closed to climbers. For information, visit the website at www.outerbanks.nc.us/Currituck Light or contact the director/lighthousekeeper at 252-453-8152. Chapter 2. What Happened to Nell Cropsey? 1109 Riverside Avenue, Elizabeth City, North Carolina. Even as a stranger visiting Elizabeth City, you soon sense that a tragedy which occurred there in 1901 is alive today. Tourists stop their cars beside the Pascotank River and stare over at the white Victorian house with its gingerbread trim. It was once the home of a young girl named Nell Cropsey. Standing on the porch, you visualize her in the living room with her sweetheart, Jim Wilcox, her five sisters, and her cousin Carrie. Nell's ghost still lingers here, a young man living in the house says. He has felt her presence on the stairs to the second floor and also in one of the bedrooms. Tree-lined Riverside Avenue is a neighborhood that some would describe as peaceful, even idyllic. But that would not be true, for beneath its calm outward appearance, the currents of the human heart, like those of the river in front of the house, once ran cruel and deep. This is the story of a girl too brash, too beautiful, and too trusting. The account is based on the court testimony of Nell's cousin Carrie, interspersed with what Carrie's thoughts may have been as she sat on the witness stand waiting for the next question. Now, for the beginning of our story. It was in the spring of 1898 when 16-year-old Nell Cropsey and her parents moved from New York to Elizabeth City. The Cropseys came from a prominent Brooklyn family and were descendants of the early Dutch settlers. William H. Cropsey, Nell's dad, chose the house that looked like a castle on Riverside, perhaps because it was impressive and had a fine view of the Pascatank River. Bill Cropsey said he had moved to the area to farm and trade. Nell was one of six girls in the family, and according to most people, she was the prettiest. Even before the Cropseys moved from Brooklyn, she was much admired, and when she arrived, the Elizabeth City girls were impressed with how Nell kept up with the latest New York styles. By early summer, Jim Wilcox was calling on her about three times a week, and Nell, only 16, was probably flattered by Jim's attentions. This must have given her confidence in a new town, where she must make friends, although the son of the county sheriff was really not her equal in family background. When Sheriff Wilcox went out to investigate a crime, his son undoubtedly went along sometimes. When they arrived on the scene, they might find an accident, someone who had been blown away with a shotgun, or the victim of a drowning. It could be anything. Sheriff Wilcox had grown accustomed to seeing the ugly, brutal side of life to which the rest of us are seldom exposed. Nell's parents may not have fully approved of Jim Wilcox, but Nell was a young girl used to having her own way. After all, she didn't hesitate to go out for a walk with a boy at 11 o'clock at night. Nell's cousin Carrie would remember the night of November 20th, 1901, for the rest of her life. She was an intelligent girl, and now she was concentrating very hard as she gave her testimony before a packed courtroom. She'd been asked to describe Nell and Jim's courtship. When Jim wasn't working, he would take Nell riding and sailing. The first Christmas, he gave her a dish with a silver handle, and the second, he gave her a gold pin with a setting of stones. On her birthday, he gave her a ring on which he had her initials cut. That was the second summer Nell and the family went to Nag's Head, and Jim made several excursions down to see them. It was on one of these evenings, when he and Nell were sitting on the porch, that her sister Ollie overheard them having a quarrel. Nell said angrily, "If you're going to act like that all season, you can stay home." Carrie had always wondered if that had not been the beginning of Nell's feelings changing toward Jim Wilcox. She did not know what he had said that night at Nag's Head to anger Nell so, but later she would think that she did know, and it made her shiver. She continued her story to the court. "I first met Jim in September of 1901 when he came to the house to call on Nell. When I came the second time and Nell and I were walking home from town, we passed the railway. Jim saw us and came across to speak. We were talking and suddenly I noticed Nell had turned on seeing him and walked way off, looking in the other direction. They didn't speak to each other at all that time. It was not until several days later that he came to the house, and then he came right often until fair time. They were very friendly at the time of the county fair. Then the temperance meetings at the church began. Jim was not interested in attending, but he would wait outside and walk Nell home after the meetings." Carrie's thoughts raced on as she waited for the next question. It may have been during the meetings that Nell, for the first time, began to see Jim more clearly, and decided that she wanted to break off their romance, but she probably was not experienced enough to know how to do it and not hurt his pride. It was too bad that he had overheard her making fun of him. Carrie went on with her testimony. One Monday afternoon, Nell and I were walking home from town, and Jim came toward us from the railway where he worked, and walked along with us. Nell didn't speak to him, and when we got home, she walked ahead into the house. Jim asked if I would go with him to the skating rink, and I told him yes, I would go. On Tuesday night, when he came around to take me, he rang, and the girls said, "There's Jim," but none of them would get up and go to the door. I said, "Girls, I'm tired of rude manners." So I let him in and went up to get my hat and coat. We stayed at the skating rink for about 45 minutes, and then we went up Poindexter Street to get some fruit. On the way home, because of the way Nell had been acting toward him, I said, "Jim, why is it Nell dislikes you so much?" He said, "You tell me and I'll tell you." I said, "You've had a quarrel, haven't you?" And he said, "No, she doesn't like me enough to go to the door with me, and I'm going to drop her." I said, "You mean she will drop you?" And he said, "That's about the size of it." He was quiet all the way home. There was a question from the clerk of court, and I happened to think that by repeating small humiliations, Nell and even her sisters seemed to be purposely hurting Jim's pride. I guess that was one way out of it for Nell. A more experienced young man than Jim would have seen she was losing interest and stopped calling. His sarcastic remarks and retreats into silence made me wonder whether Jim Wilcox would take rejection well. I continued my testimony. When I got in from going ice skating with Jim, I found Nell and Ollie. Nell said, "I certainly would enjoy a good apple," and I said, "Where's the fruit, Jim?" He said, "It's in the sitting room. It's yours. Go get it." It was passed around, but when it got to Nell, after just saying she wanted it, she said, "No, thank you." After a while, Jim went home. I thought Nell had gone from tolerating him to purposely trying to insult him. Just after he went out, all of us began to laugh, and I said, "Nell, I had to laugh at you when you refused that apple because I knew you wanted one." She was eating it when I got back from the door. I said, "Nell, you certainly ought to have seen us at the rink. We look so funny. I am so tall, and Jim is so short. I felt like an elephant going in there with that little thing." She said, "Why don't you just call him Squatty?" We sat and talked for a while before we went to bed. For some reason, Nell's description, "Squatty, Squatty," kept going through Carrie's mind over and over. The next day, Nell's sister Lett and I drove over to town. Jim saw us and walked up when we were ready to leave. Lett said, "Why don't you come over and harness the horse for us, Jim?" And he said, "I have played lackey long enough." He got up in the back of the buggy. Staring at me, he said, "You are a nice girl in a very cold sort of way." "What's the matter, Jim?" I asked. "Listeners never hear any good of themselves," he said. "As I left last night, my cigarette went out, and I stopped to light it and heard what you said." I said, "I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings." Jim Wilcox had heard me call him that little thing and heard the girl he had dated for 2 years say, "Just call him Squatty." He shrugged his shoulders. "Oh, Jimmy doesn't care," he said. But I think he really did care. Any man would have. When we got home, he went in with us, and Nell was playing the harmonica, so I played the mandolin. Nell said, "We will have fun on the Old Dominion boat. We will play and then pass the hat around." We laughed. Jim suddenly left. I think we were probably unkind to anticipate our pleasure on the trip we were going on without him. Nell seemed to enjoy remarks of this sort. About 8 o'clock that night, November 20th, he came back. Everyone gradually went out until it was just Jim, Ollie, Nell, and I were left in the room. I noticed how quiet he was. Once he was smiling, and I said, "What are you smiling at, Jim?" He said, "Was I smiling? I didn't know it." Then he said something about drowning. He told us he was nearly drowned one time, and what a fine sensation it was. Nell said she would never want to drown, as all her hair would come out, and she would look like a fright, and she wanted to freeze to death. I thought that an odd comment for anyone her age to make. Carrie concluded her testimony. I said some nonsense, and in a little while I went upstairs. I remember it was a bright moonlit night. Mine is the room over the sitting room, and the shutters were open. In about 20 minutes I went to bed. What happened next is filled in for us by Nell's sister Ollie's testimony. At 11 o'clock, Jim Wilcox took his hat from the rocking chair and started out. When he got in the hall, the door was partly open. He walked out and said, "Nell, can I see you out here a minute?" Nell had looked at Ollie but said nothing and gone out into the hall with Jim Wilcox. She was never seen alive again. This was the first time she had gone to the door with Wilcox since November 7th, although he had been at her house every other night. Ollie thought her sister had gone upstairs ahead of her. Carrie heard Ollie come up and did not wake again until she heard a terrible confusion of voices outside. Nell was not in her bed, nor could anyone find her in the house or outside. The river was dragged, but Nell's body was not recovered. It was found several weeks later, tied to a stake, floating face down, about 50 yards from shore, almost in front of her home. Although many people thought Jim Wilcox was guilty and he was sent to prison, he steadfastly maintained his innocence for the rest of his life. It is hard to look at this town today and picture its saloons and lawlessness in 1901. Nell Cropsey went out alone after 11 and was never seen alive again. The son of the family now living in the Cropsey house believes that the spirit of the dead girl sometimes walks behind him up the stairs to the second floor, and he has felt her presence in his room. "It is a sad spirit," says he. "I hope that one day Nell may be freed from this house and from any memories of the night she was murdered a century ago." "Can you tell me who killed me?" the girl who plays Nell's ghost asks in the annual October Ghost Walk drama, as she ascends the inside stairs. If the old house knows, it does not answer. Jim Wilcox was convicted, served his time in jail, and later killed himself without telling whatever he knew. Some are uncertain even today that the right man was sentenced. All anyone knows is that it would take the most callous, cruel person to strike this girl a blow on the forehead and toss her body into the Pascatank River. There is more than one lesson to be learned from the story of Nell Cropsey. According to a quote from the book Into the Sound Country by Bland and Anne Carey Simpson, Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina Press, 1997, mothers have cautioned their daughters in the years since the crime to make sure their dates see them safely into their own house, lest you wind up out there dead in the sound like that Nell Cropsey. But somehow the words of the ghost of Nell still cry out for the answer to her tragic question. Can you tell me who killed me? This house is private property and not open to the public. Chapter 3. A New Mystery of the Lost Colony, Roanoke Island, North Carolina. This is a story of why and how a young single woman in 16th century England decided to leave her family and embark on the great adventure of her day. As he was becoming an old man, the secretary to the lord of a great manor decided to teach a young girl named Rose Payne to read and write, so that there might always be someone to take care of his lordship's accounts and write his receipts. The Payne family were good people, serfs bound to the soil, who lived in a small cottage not far from the manor house. Normally it would have been Rose's brother, Rolf, who would assist the aged secretary, but the boy was born simple. Rose was bright, and that is how a girl in the late 1500s came to be one of the few people in the England of her day who could read and write. She wrote the daily receipts for items his lordship sold to surrounding landowners or purchased from merchants, and due to her frequent presence in the manor, she met and fell in love with the lord's son, Philip. But she soon discovered his lordship had more ambitious plans for Philip than marriage to the daughter of a serf. Young Philip had been engaged since he was 9 to a child of 5, the daughter of a wealthy adjoining landowner. When his lordship saw Rose and his son together, he was much disturbed. Calling Rose aside, he explained the impossibility of such a romance. He offered her the gift of freedom for her family, and, if she chose, a free passage for herself to the new world. Although she knew a deep sadness, Rose Payne wasted little time feeling bitter. She had never dared aspire to marrying Philip, even though he had led her to dream such a thing might be possible. But fortunately, Rose had developed a vision. She saw herself rising above her circumstances through her newly acquired skills of reading and writing. When presented with the opportunity to cross the sea to a new land, she accepted eagerly. What did the daughter of a serf have to look forward to in England, where customs of class and family bound each person from the cradle to the grave? I want you to know you don't have to go on this voyage of colonization if you choose not to, said her father. Your mother's sister would see that you got on at the Fitzgilbert Manor House, where she serves. Do you really want to be one of this group of colonists leaving for the New World, daughter? I, Rose repeated firmly, and her heart leaped at the chance. Her father drove her in the farm wagon to London to embark with the other colonists on the first stage of her journey. Arriving just before noon, she and her father walked along the street. Rose must have stared at her first view of the bustling, rough-and-tumble city of London. Fine ladies drew up their silk skirts to keep them from being dirtied by the muddy thoroughfare. Smelly fishmongers and peddlers raucously shouted their wares. Hard-faced men and women stopped people and begged. A ragged woman lurched into Rose and snatched at her pocketbook, but the girl managed to shake free of her. London was no place to be out in alone, she thought, and she shrank from the horrors of the plague-ridden city. Surely the New World would be a better, cleaner place for the eyes than this. Rose Payne and the other colonists left Portsmouth, England, on April 26, 1587, and reached Roanoke Island on July 22nd. Sunburned to such a dark hue that she hardly recognized herself, Rose had learned something about the sea and how to help the men haul the yards forward and trim sail. She lined up with the others in front of the dunes on the beach, while Ananias Dare called the roll. Eleanor Dare, Henry Barry, John Sampson, Margaret Lawrence, Ambrose Vickers, Elizabeth Vickers, Peter Little, Martin Sutton, William Dutton, Rose Payne. Rose Payne listened until 100 and at least a score more had been accounted for. Among them were couples, single men, and a handful of unmarried women. I am one of the few, Rose thought, looking at Agnes Wood and Jane Mannering, who were also single. She discovered on the voyage that they were brave, stalwart girls whom she could rely upon. What a relief it was to reach land, although of the group, Governor John White, James Lacey, and probably John Wright were the only ones who had ever seen this island before. The captain of the ship, Simon Fernandez, was an unsavory character with whom Governor White continually argued. In fact, White's decision to hire this man would prove a fatal error. On the voyage, White had problems restraining Fernandez from acts of piracy whenever the fellow saw a ship worth plundering. Now, rascal that he was, he left all the settlers at Roanoke Island, stubbornly refusing to carry them on to their original destination. Fernandez had agreed to take them to Chesapeake Bay to join an already established settlement. Leaving them at Roanoke, where there were no English settlers, and in the month of August, meant disaster. They could not plant and grow corn, which they would need as a staple crop, just as it had always been a staple for the Indians, until the following summer. When the colonists' small store of supplies was exhausted, they would be dependent on whatever the Indians could share with them. The tribe on the nearby mainland was hostile, and Mandio's community of friendly Indians on Croatian Island was a day's sail away. Many of the colonists grumbled that too little thought was given to practical matters when they arrived. Instead, much time was taken up in the first weeks with lengthy celebrations. There was Manio's baptism and the christening of Virginia Dare, the first child born on the island. Then there was a ceremony of presenting the island of Roanoke to Manteo, the Indian who had become the colonist's friend, and who was acting as Queen Elizabeth's trustee. Meanwhile, irreplaceable supplies were dwindling. The days of good weather were being squandered, and hurricane season was on the way. Time was running out. White had never planned for the permanent colony to be located here. They were to settle 50 miles farther north, where they would join other colonists. There were many reports of an English settlement and fort on Chesapeake Bay. According to John White's maps, the route would be through various Indian villages and along the southern edge of Chesapeake Bay to the site of Skikowak, a large settlement of the Chesapeake tribe. White, the explorer, knew something of the Chesapeake's language, and many of the colonists had been taught useful Chesapeake words and phrases during the voyage from England. Leader and governor of this new effort to establish a colony, White was by profession a talented artist, and at heart an ambitious adventurer. His ambition had already been rewarded by his incorporation into Sir Walter Raleigh's company, which promised grants of 500 acres of land, Indian land, to Governor White and his 12 assistants. In addition, each assistant had been accorded the status of gentleman, a corps of men of rank who accompanied the monarch on military expeditions or other important occasions. This honor was of more use in England than in the wilds of this new and primitive country. Governor White's daughter, Eleanor, had just married one of his assistants, Ananias Dare. It is surprising that White allowed his daughter to be part of such a dangerous venture in the first place. The presence of few women among the colonists indicates that many of the men had decided not to risk the lives of their wives and children. Despite the attractiveness of land grants to colonists coming from a country where land was primarily in the hands of the nobility, only 118 of the expected 150 people undertook the voyage. Single women like Rose were perhaps the most determined to go, and had the least to lose. All they could aspire to in England was the tilling the land that belonged to the lord of the manor, or life as house servants. Their modest hut or tiny cottage, its furnishings, their clothing, whatever possessions they had were provided by the owner of the estate. A few were permitted to work for wages and keep part of the money. Some finally succeeded in buying their freedom, while a few ran away. Without even the tools and conveniences they were accustomed to in England, the girls found ways to help each other on the voyage. When they reached the abandoned settlement of the first colonists, they set about repairing the damage wind and seawater had done to the cottages of the 1585 settlers. Rose, who learned how to haul yards and trim sail when help was needed on the boat on the voyage over, had inherited her father's skill with her hands. Agnes came from a family that tilled the soil for a manor house, and she was frustrated at not being able to sow any of the seeds she had brought from England in the short time they were to be here. She recognized edible wild plants akin to some she knew in England. Jane's father was a woodsman and trapper, and more than once she fed the others and won admiration through her ability to trap small animals. Life on Roanoke Island, exposed to the heat, the wind, and the sea, was totally unlike anything they had expected. Those of humble birth began adjusting to the hardships more readily than those of more gentle birth, who had less experience in working with their hands. It was evident from the first that the colony was going to run out of food, but for some weeks the problem seems to have been ignored. The only solution was for someone to go back to England and return as soon as possible with desperately needed staples, seed, tools, and other stores. Governor John White was the person best able to wangle the supplies. And finally it was decided that he would go back to England and return with what was needed. It was necessary for him to take some of the single men as his crew for the voyage back, although this left the remainder of the small group more vulnerable to Indian attack. White probably appointed the man he considered the most trustworthy of his assistants, Ananias Dare, to lead the colonists in his absence. Ananias was his son-in-law, and White undoubtedly feared his daughter would elect to stay with her husband, despite the welfare of their infant daughter, Virginia. He was right. According to the examination of John White's papers in later years, he knew that the colonists were preparing for a 50-mile journey to a settlement on Chesapeake Bay. He left general directions along with a crudely drawn map. The colonists who remained must reach it or starve to death. As White hugged his daughter and granddaughter and told Ananias goodbye, he had no idea that his voyage back to England was to take 6 months. During the trip, he encountered an accident, pirates, and bad weather, and he was blown off course. Finally, he arrived in Ireland rather than England. Ananias's leadership abilities must have been sorely tested soon after his father-in-law left. The colonists could not agree on where to go. In any case, we can imagine that some wanted to stay and await the return of Governor White with their supplies. Ananias and Eleanor were possibly among them because of the presence of a new baby in their lives. Ananias may have thought it best to wait here so that his wife's father would know where to find them upon his return. Finally, after a number of months had passed and food ran low, they doubtless began to lose faith in White's returning with food within 6 months. It would certainly have been tempting to sail to the tribe of Mandio and their Indian friends at Croatian, now Hatteras Island. Having lived 2 years in England, Mandio would be a link between them and his tribe. The colonists would expect to be taken in as friends at Croatian Island, where Mandio's mother was chief of a village. They would be granted food and refuge there, near what is now the town of Buxton. And so, when John White eventually returned to Roanoke in 1590, he found only some iron cannon remaining where the settlement had been. Later, a wooden chest, filled with papers and several coats of mail, was found buried beneath the sand. The colonists would normally have taken the chest with them, but the suits of mail could be melted down into bullets, although for a small boat the mail might have proved too heavy to take. We have no answer as to when they left. There is no evidence of a sudden attack upon the colony by hostile Indians causing them to flee. If that had been the case, they would have added a cross to signal distress when they carved Croatian on a tree before they left. Either their departure was the result of a studied decision to join Mantio's tribe at Croatian, or they all perished in a hurricane. If they lived with the Indians in the several years that passed until White's long-delayed return, not in 6 months, but almost 3 years later, the colonists would probably have adopted Indian ways and gradually merged into the life of the tribe. And now we consider an entirely new story. White's papers indicate that in this colony were a number of men and women who were planning to leave right after his departure for England. After listening to Governor White's report of a pleasant settlement beside Chesapeake Bay, some 50 miles to the north, White seemed convinced of its existence. One group of colonists decided to attempt to find it. They hoped to join other English settlers there. Knowing Rose Payne's temperament and courage, let us assume she eagerly cast her lot with them. She had some knowledge of sailing, perhaps even in the small two-masted vessel called a pinnace that had accompanied the larger ship on their crossing from England. It could carry about 35 passengers. Some of the other girls may well have joined her in thinking that this was their best choice to avoid starvation or confrontation with hostile Indians. To approach the Chesapeake by water, the pinnace would have to sail across Albemarle Sound, enter the mouth of the Chowan River, and then proceed north toward Chesapeake Bay. The colonists had listened to Governor White describe this plan just before he left on August 27, 1587. He had meant to try it himself. It had also seemed practical to Governor Ralph Lane, the leader of the earlier colony. Currituck and Pamlico Sounds were too shallow to navigate, and the currents of the Roanoke River too treacherous. Since the Roanoke headed west, the Chowan River was the best northern route. It may have been mid-September when Rose packed her few possessions and prepared to leave Roanoke Island with the adventurous group she had chosen. As she parted from the colonists who had decided to wait for Governor White's return with provisions, or possibly join Manteo on Croatian, she eyed the waters of the Sound with apprehension. In recent weeks she had learned some of its moods. The wind had been rising all morning, and the waves were dark and choppy. Flocks of birds flew high above her head toward the mainland. Had the birds received some secret warning of bad weather to come? Did these signs mean they should leave now on their trip or delay it? Surely there were colonists wiser than she. She would have to trust their judgment. As Rose packed, she held up one of the few dresses she had brought from England, made of pale sea-green flax, and touched it to her face. It was the dress she had worn on her last meeting with Philip, the lord of the manor's son. She felt a twinge of sadness. Suppose he came to Virginia some day and saw her after she became a fine lady in the city of Raleigh. Perhaps then. But she knew it as a vain hope. One of the first of perhaps 30 to board, she felt the motion of the ship under her feet. Memories of the voyage from England came back to her, and it was good to be on the water again. Finally, sails set and a strong wind at their back, she watched the pinnace round the end of the island and nose into the Sound. Its usually smooth water was a dark pewter gray and rough. The trip up the Chowan River was only a day's sail, which presented far less danger from hostile Indians than a trip by land. When they reached the closest point to Chesapeake Bay, then they would leave the ship and walk the rest of the way, a journey of about 3 days. As they went, she and Jane would hunt, trap, and fish to provide food. Two men who stood at the rail near the girls spoke of hoping to receive aid from the Chowanokes and other friendly tribes, but one reminded the other that Governor Lane's murder of a powerful Indian has hurt our relations with them. By noon the next day, the wind was reaching hurricane intensity. "Hurry, furl the sails!" shouted Rose to a young Welshman near her, but even as she grasped a rope herself, she saw he was no sailor. Drenched by torrential rain, they sped through the water with frightening speed, gusts causing the sails of the pinnace to billow and strain at their ropes. The ship tossed wildly beneath them, and they were soon clinging to the rigging for their very lives. The wind rose until the boat was racing along before it. Suddenly the terrified girl glimpsed ahead what must be Holiday Island, as she remembered it from Governor White's map. From out of the storm roared a dark, swirling column of wind. With a loud whirring sound, it hurled the ship aloft. Now it was airborne. Pitching, twisting, soaring, it disgorged its passengers in every direction, tossing them out like rag dolls. If there had been an audience watching this horrifying spectacle, they might not have believed their eyes. Who could have imagined an airborne sailing vessel headed in the direction of Holiday Island? Then the fierce hold of the tornado finally loosened, allowing the ship and its contents to plummet behind a curtain of trees in the depths of that yet unexplored and mysterious swamp called the Great Dismal. The schooner could well have been lifted and carried some distance by one of the tornadoes that hurricanes often spawn. Pilot Don Upchurch of Ahoskie, North Carolina, cites a storm surge that during one hurricane carried a house 12 miles up the New River. He says, "Lifted with sufficient force by wind, anything can fly." 3 centuries later, in the mid-1800s, an astonishing discovery was made. The aged, rotting hulk of a 2-masted pinnace was found in the Dismal Swamp not far from Acorn Hill in Gates County. Its location was reported to be 10 miles from navigable water. Some 50 years after the discovery, a shoemaker and his son in Gates County stood staring in amazement at the ancient rotting spars and brass fittings. They did not know that the old brass on the ship came from vessels of 350 years before. They had no idea of the importance of their finding. Brass nails for shoes was all the father and son were thinking about, and they stripped the ship of them. They took them back, along with other brass fittings, to Bennett Brass, near a small North Carolina crossroads called Sunbury. Here the Chowan River intersects with Bennett Creek. Even today, there may be shoes, once worn on colonists' feet, lying buried in the mud. The source of Bennett Creek is Dismal Swamp. Its bed is still there. Upchurch believes the pinnace the shoemaker stumbled upon belonged to the 1587 lost colony. Perhaps the remains of courageous Rose Payne and her sister colonists are at this very moment somewhere in the Great Dismal, the swamp shrouded in mystery. Don Upchurch of Ahoskie has devoted years to researching the mystery vessel of the Dismal Swamp. He has done satellite imaging of the area, and the bed is shown on the computer. This is lowland, and there are still trees there. It is somewhat dried up, but Upchurch believes that at an earlier date a ship could possibly have navigated it. Ships of the pinnace type drew only about 4 feet of water. Roanoke Island and the site where the vessel was seen are only 97 miles apart, and between them lie the Albemarle Sound and the Chowan River. Rose Payne really was one of the colonists, although details of her previous life and her eventual fate are speculation. We do know she must have had little or no hope of anything better at home in England, for she risked her life making this voyage. If some day we learn more of this mystery, perhaps we might discover a happier ending for the brave Rose. In a storm in 1815, which made landfall near Swansboro, North Carolina, a house was carried by a storm surge from the Onslow area nearly 12 miles up the New River until the house reached Stones Bay. Water is pushed up rivers and sometimes goes an incredible distance inland during hurricanes. A greater ability to keep visual and statistical records of hurricane wind intensity and storm and tornado damage during the last half century has led to estimates of wind speeds as high as 200 miles an hour. When the Labor Day storm of 1935 washed over the Florida Keys on September 3rd, there was a surge of water 25 feet high and a death toll as high as 408 lives. In fact, we don't even know the upper limits on statistics like these, according to a book by Jay Barnes entitled North Carolina's Hurricane History, Chapel Hill, University of North Carolina Press, 1995. Chapter 4. The Ghostly Lodger, Roanoke Island Inn, Manio, North Carolina. The Roanoke Island Inn is a picturesque refuge in the small coastal port of Manio, home of the outdoor drama The Lost Colony. As you pass through a wide archway, you are greeted by the heavy fragrance of pittosporum and the welcoming vision of the inn itself. A large house, reminiscent of those in the Caribbean, it is framed by the cool giants of a giant live oak, and on the gallery porch above your head a ceiling fan turns lazily. Three dip nets for catching blue crabs hang on the wall of the inn. There is something timeless about this place, so that your first impression is of entering a quiet sanctuary safe from the cares of the world. The ghost here must feel that way too. More than a century old, this house had been small when its first owners, Asa Jones and his wife Martha, built it back in the 1860s. With each generation, it grew larger. Now in the hands of architect John Wilson, a great-great-grandson of Asa Jones, the house has again doubled in size. Wilson, an islander, decided to redecorate it and open part of it as the Roanoke Island Inn. In the entrance is a large central lighting fixture of intertwining cattails, beautifully crafted of bronze, and spreading above it is a gloriously painted faux sky. A young North Carolina artist spends weeks depicting this airy, cerulean world. It seems as real as the crystal vase full of fresh mint that sits nearby, ready to lend pungency to a guest's glass of lemonade. Books fill the shelves on either side of the fireplace, and you sense that you will find this a place of spiritual renewal and peace. Ada, the innkeeper, is waiting to greet you. You will know Ada Hadley by her long dark hair and her unusual accent. She came to Manio from the island of Newfoundland, and when she talks about the fierce storms in her homeland, as those who live on islands often do, her storms in Newfoundland are an impressive blend of tropical hurricane and blizzard, bringing snow as high as the stovepipe. For Ada, strange events began happening in her new island home right after her arrival. I was taking care of Mr. Wilson's grandfather on the second floor one night when I saw the figure of a huge man standing in the hall right in front of me. I saw his body and the shadowy features of his face, and he was looking straight through me. So terrified was I that I threw up my hands and pled the covering blood of Jesus, and then I flew down the stairs. On another occasion, Ada was sitting talking to Remy Lane, a friend of hers who lives here at the inn, when she heard a loud crash. She ran downstairs, and on the floor found a vase filled with flowers that had been hurled across the room. Miraculously, the crystal was unbroken. As we were picking up the flowers and mopping up water, we heard another sound, this time of glass shattering. It was a second vase, but this one had broken into many pieces. A day soon afterward, I heard a sound upstairs in one of the bedrooms while I was upstairs cleaning. I knew which room it was and went in immediately. This was the room in which Mr. Roscoe Jones' wife died. The window had just opened of its own accord, and the wind was blowing the curtain straight out. There was no good my reporting it to Mr. Wilson, because everyone in the house knows the story of the ghost. The ghost was a member of the Wilson family, and his name is Roscoe. Of course, the question most people ask is, why did Roscoe become a ghost? Roscoe had been a postmaster for many years in Manio. Until he received a pink slip from the U.S. Postal Service, it had never occurred to him that he wouldn't be postmaster there for the rest of his life. He would not accept that losing his job could happen when there was a change of administration in Washington. He wouldn't listen when his family told him it was just politics. To him, it was more than unfair to replace him. It was the greatest humiliation of his life. A tall, slightly stoop-shouldered man with pale blue eyes, close-cropped gray hair, and a somber countenance, Roscoe Jones turned in his key at the post office and walked down Fernando Street. Rounding the curve that neared the water, he stopped in front of the house where he lived with his wife and family and stood staring at its entrance. He knew that this would be his final look at its exterior, and he wanted to savor it. His eyes traveled over to the vines and lingered on the roses he had planted that climbed up to the gallery porch. He knew almost to the day each year when he could walk out the front door in the morning and see the first dewy buds of the season. For a moment he stopped and inhaled their fragrance. Towering above him was a steep-pitched bonnet roof with 8 dormer windows that he and his wife, Miss Essie, had added on. It had been just right for their 4 children. He loved everything about this house, and he would never want to leave it. He thought of the many times he had come home here, after a day of supervising people on the mail routes, and watching his 2 clerks to see that they obeyed regulations. His life would never be the same. Those faceless men in Washington took his job away from him, and didn't know what a wicked thing it was to dismiss a man this way. He would never be able to look anyone in the eye again. Without speaking to his wife or the other members of his family, former postmaster Roscoe Jones mounted the stairs to the 2nd floor and went into his room. When his wife called him for supper, he did not appear. In fact, no matter how the rest of the family called or cajoled, Roscoe never came down the stairs again in the presence of his family for the rest of his life. Mrs. Jones left a plate of food for him on a table, and he would come down late at night and take it upstairs to eat. A few years later, Roscoe died, and not long afterward, the figure of a man in a postal uniform began to be seen leaving the house or entering the front door. Sometimes people downstairs would turn their head just in time to see a tall, shadowy, stooped man ascending the stairs. "It's the postmaster. This house was his home, and he just doesn't want to leave," is the way I try to explain it, says Ada. His ghost has also closed the door of a room while I'm working in it, and not only startled me, but became a bother. I knew it could only be him, and I was becoming irritated, so I started rebuking him, saying, "Go away, Roscoe. I can't play these games now." I think it often works, but sometimes, after I pull a blind down, he will pull it back up several times until I speak quite sharply to him. Then he will stop. "Do you mind such weird happenings?" asked a guest. "No, not in the daytime," said Ada. "It's the noises at night that bother me. Footsteps are sometimes heard by our guests in room number 7. Last week a lady was here, and she asked me who was staying above her. She kept hearing the footsteps of someone walking back and forth, above her in a room we have never rented. It is only a storage area, and we think that end of the attic was part of Roscoe's quarters. Somehow, those footsteps are worse than his turning the radio on in room number 3. The playing of the radio has attracted the attention of housekeeping. Although the room has been unoccupied each time the night before, and no one has been in it to clean, they often hear music or voices inside it in the morning. Owner John Wilson says, "I have never seen the ghost, but I do have reports of his activities from my housekeeping staff and sometimes from our guests." It had been over a year since I talked with Ada, the innkeeper. She called today, and we talked for a few minutes. I started to ask how Roscoe the ghost was, but she spoke first, as if I would know just who she was talking about. "He's showing himself some again," she said. "Takes these spells of not letting us know he's here, and then he does something like he did 2 weeks ago. Came up behind my daughter and pushed her, not a soul around." The Roanoke Island Inn is located at 305 Fernando Street. For information or reservations, phone 252-473-5511. We've run out of time for today's chapter of Ghosts from the Coast, a ghostly tour of coastal North Carolina and South Carolina by Nancy Roberts. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Joyner, reading for the Triangle Reading Service. So long until next time.